It was my instinct to turn away, to give him his privacy, but Howard stared into his face and, taking his hand, said, "See how Granger really feels us." He squeezed her hand back. "Not just with his brain, but with his heart." A not-so-subtle rebuke intended for me. The fierce young lady nodded. We waited for more. It seemed only she could bring a final meaning to the episode, but her baby had finished feeding and her speech was done. She pulled up her yellow wrapper and stood to burp him. "It is an amazing thing to have our sister Amy here with us," said one of Howard's friends, a lively young woman called Esther, who I'd noticed disliked any hint of silence. "Her name is known all over the world, but she is one of us now. We will have to give her a village name." "Yes," I said. I was watching the woman in the yellow wrapper who had spoken. Now she was wandering towards the dancing, her back so straight. I wanted to follow her and talk some more.
"Is she here now? Our sister, Amy?"
"What? Oh, no. I think she had to go and do some interviews or something."
"Oh, it is amazing. She knows Jay-Z, she knows Rihanna and Beyoncé."
"Yes."
"And she knows Michael Jackson?"
"Yes."
"Do you think she is Illuminati, too? Or she just is acquaintances with Illuminati?"
I could still make out the woman in yellow, distinctive among so many others, until she passed behind a tree and the toilet block, and I couldn't find her again. I wouldn't... Honestly, Esther, I don't think any of that stuff is real.
"Oh,
well," said Esther equably, as if she'd said she liked chocolate and I'd said I didn't.
"Here, for us, it is real, because there is a lot of power there for sure. We hear a lot about this."
"It is real," confirmed Howa.
"But on this internet, believe me, you can't trust everything. For example, my cousin showed me photos of this white man in America. He was as big as four men, so fat. I said, 'Are you so foolish? This is not a real photograph. Come on. It's not possible. No one could be like this. These kids are crazy. They believe everything they see.'"
By the time we made our way back to the compound, it was black outside, starlit. I linked arms with Lamin and Howa and tried teasing them a little.
"No, no, no. Even although I call her the little wife," protested Lamin, "and she calls me Mr. Husband, it is the truth that we are just age mates." "Flirt, flirt, flirt," said Howa, flirting. "And that's it."
"And that's it?" I asked, kicking the door wide with my foot. "That is certainly it," said Lamin. In the compound, many of the younger children were still awake and ran to Howa, delighted as she was delighted to receive them. I shook hands with all four grandmothers, which always had to be done as if it were the first time, and each woman leant in to try to tell me something important, or, more accurately, did tell me something important, which I happened not to understand, and then, when words failed, as they always did, pulled me slightly by my wrapper towards the far end of the porch.
"Oh," said Howa, walking over with a nephew in her arms. "But there is my brother."
He was a half-brother, in fact, and did not look much like Howa to me, was not beautiful like her, and had none of her flair. He had a kind, serious face, which was round like hers but double-chinned with it, a smart pair of glasses, and an utterly neutral way of dressing that told me, before he did, that he must have spent time in America. He was standing on the veranda, drinking a large mug of Lipton's, his elbows resting on the lip of the concrete wall. I came round the pillar to shake hands with him. He took my hand warmly, but with his head drawn back and half a smirk, as if bracketing the gesture in irony. It reminded me of someone. My mother.
"And you're staying here in the compound, I see," he said,
and nodded at the quiet industry all round us, the shrieking nephew in Howard's arms, whom she now released to the yard.
"But how does rural village life treat you? You have to first habituate yourself to the circumstances to appreciate it fully, I think."
Instead of answering him, I asked him where he had learnt his perfect English. He smiled formally, but his eyes hardened briefly behind his glasses.
"Here. This is an English-speaking country."
Howa, unsure what to do with this awkwardness, giggled into her hand. "I'm enjoying it very much," I said, blushing. "Howa has been very kind.
You like the food?
It's really delicious.
He's simple. He patted his well-rounded belly and handed his empty bowl to a passing girl. But sometimes the simple is more flavorsome than the complicated.
Yes, exactly.
So, in conclusion, everything is good.
Everything is good.
It takes a while to acclimatize to this rural village life, as I say. Even for me, it takes a minute, and I was born here.
Somebody now passed me a bowl of food, though I had already eaten, but as I felt that everything I did in front of Howard's brother was being presented as a kind of test, I took it.
But you can't eat like that, he fussed, and when I tried to rest the bowl on the wall, said, Let's sit.
Lamin and Howard stayed resting against the wall, while we lowered ourselves onto a pair of slightly wonky homemade stools. No longer under the eyes of every soul in the yard, Howard's brother relaxed. He told me he had gone to a good school in the city, near the university his father had taught in, and from that school had applied for a place at a private Quaker college in Kansas, which gave 10 scholarships a year to African students, and he had been one of them. Thousands apply, but he got in. They liked his essay, though it was so long ago now he barely remembered what it was about. He did graduate work in Boston, in economics. Later, he lived in Minneapolis, Rochester, and Boulder, all places I had visited at one time or another with Amy, and none of which had ever meant a thing to me. Yet now I found I wanted to hear about them, perhaps because a day spent in the village felt, to me, like a year. Time radically slowed there. So much so that now even Howard's brother's tan slacks and red golf t-shirt could apparently inspire an exile's nostalgic fondness in me. I asked him a lot of very specific questions about his time spent in my not-quite-home, while Lamin and Howard stood next to us, frozen out of the conversational picture. "But why did you have to leave?" I asked him, more plaintively than I'd intended. He looked at me shrewdly.
"Nothing compelled me at all. I could have stayed. I came back to serve my country. I wanted to return. I work for the Treasury."
"Oh, for the government?"
"Yes. But to him, our treasury is like a personal money box. You are a bright young woman. I'm sure you probably heard about that." He took a strip of gum from his pocket and was a long time removing the silver foil. "You understand when I say serve my country. I mean all of the people, not one man. You'll understand, too, that at the moment our hands are tied, but they won't always be. I love my country. And when things change, at least I will be here to see it."
"Babu, right now you are here one day,"
protested Hawa, throwing her arms around her brother's neck.
"And I want to talk to you about the drama in this yard, never mind the city."
Brother and sister inclined their heads affectionately towards each other.
"Sister, I don't doubt the situation here is more complicated. Wait, I would like to finish this point for our concerned guest. You see, my last stop was New York. Am I correct in understanding that you're from New York?" I said yes. It was easier. "Then you will know how it is and how class works in America. Frankly, it was too much for me. I'd really had enough of it by the time I reached New York. Of course, we have a system of class here, too, but not the contempt."
"The contempt?"
"Now, let's see. This compound you are in? This is our family you are among. Well, actually, a very, very small portion of it, but it will do in this example. Maybe to you they live very simply. They are rural village people. But we are Foros, originally nobles, through my grandmother's line. Some people you will meet, the headmaster, for example, is a Nayamolos, which means his people were artisans. They come in different varieties, blacksmiths, leather workers, etc. Or, Lamin, your family are Jali, aren't they?" An extremely strained look passed over Lamin's face. He nodded in a minimal way, and then looked up and away, at the huge full moon threatening to slot itself into the mango tree. "Musicians, storytellers, griots," said Howard's brother, miming the strumming of an instrument. "While some people, on the other hand, are Jongo, many in our village are descended from Jongos."
"I don't know what that is."
"The descendants of slaves."
He smiled as he looked me up and down. But my point is, the people here are still able to say, of course, Ejongo is different from me, but I do not have contempt for him. Under God's eye, we have our difference, but also our basic equality. In New York, I saw low-class people treated in a way I never imagined was possible, with total contempt. They are serving food, and people are not making even eye contact with them. Believe it or not, I was sometimes treated that way myself. There are so many different ways to be poor, murmured Howard in a sudden leap of inspiration. She was in the middle of collecting a pile of fish bones from the floor. And rich, I said. And Howard's brother, smiling faintly, conceded the point. 6. The morning after the show, the doorbell rang, too early, earlier than a postman. It was Miss Isabel, distraught. The cash boxes were gone, with almost £300 in them, and no sign of a break-in. Someone had let themselves in, overnight. My mother sat on the edge of the sofa in her dressing gown, rubbing her eyes against the morning light. I listened in from the doorway, my innocence presumed from the start. The discussion was what to do about Tracy. After a while, I was brought in and questioned, and I told the truth. We locked up at 11:30, stacking all the chairs, after which Tracy went her way and I went mine. I thought she posted the key back through the door, but of course it's possible she pocketed it. My mother and Miss Isabel turned to me as I spoke, but they listened without much interest, their faces blank, and the moment I had finished, they turned away and returned to their discussion. The more I listened, the more alarmed I became. There was something obscenely complacent to me in their certainty, both of Tracy's guilt and my innocence, even though I understood, rationally, that Tracy must have been involved in some way. I listened to their theories. Miss Isabel believed Louis must have stolen the key. My mother was equally sure he'd been given it. It didn't seem unusual at the time that neither of them considered calling the police. "With a family like that," said Miss Isabel, and accepted a tissue to dab at her eyes. "When she comes into the center," my mother assured her, "I'll have a talk." It was the first I'd heard of Tracy going to the youth center, the one at which my mother volunteered, and now she looked up at me, startled. It took her a moment to regain her cool, but without looking me in the eye, she began to smoothly explain that, after the incident with the drugs, she had naturally arranged for Tracy to get some free counseling, and if she hadn't told me, that was because of confidentiality. She hadn't even told Tracy's mother. Now I see that none of this was especially unreasonable, but at the time I saw maternal conspiracies everywhere, manipulations, attempts to control my life and the lives of my friends. I made a fuss and fled to my room. Everything happened quickly after that. Miss Isabel, in her innocence, went to talk to Tracy's mother and was more or less chased out of their flat, returning to ours looking shaken, her face pinker than ever. My mother sat her down again and went to make tea, but a moment later we heard the sound of the open front door banging in its frame. Tracy's mother, propelled by her own unfinished fury across the road, up the stairs and into our lounge, where she stayed long enough to make a counter-accusation, a terrible one, about Mr. Booth. It was loud enough that I heard it through the ceiling. I ran down the stairs and right into her. She was filling the doorway, defiant, full of contempt, for me.
"You and your fucking mother," she said. "You've always thought you were better than us, always thought you were some kind of bloody golden child, but turns out it ain't you at all, is it? It's my Tracy, and all of you are just fucking jealous, and I'll be dead before I let you people get in our way. She's got her whole life in front of her, and you can't stop her with lies. None of you can."
No adult had ever spoken to me like that before, as if they despised me. According to her, I was trying to ruin Tracy's life, and so was my mother, and so were Miss Isabel and Mr. Booth and miscellaneous others on the estate, and all the jealous mothers from dance class. I ran, crying, back up the stairs, and she screamed,
"You can cry as much as you bloody want, love."
Upstairs, I heard the front door slam, and for several hours everything went quiet. Just before supper, my mother came up to my room and asked a series of delicate questions, the only time the subject of sex ever came up explicitly between us, and I made it as clear as I could that Mr. Booth had never laid a hand on me or on Tracy, nor anyone else, as far as I knew. It didn't help. By the end of the week, he was forced to give up playing the piano in Miss Isabel's dance class. I don't know what happened to him after that, whether he carried on living in the neighbourhood, or moved away, or died, or was simply broken by the rumours. I thought of my mother's intuition. Something serious happened to that girl. And I felt now that she was right as usual, and that if we had only asked Tracy the proper questions at the right moment, and in a more delicate way, we might have got the truth. Instead, our timing was bad. We backed her and her mother into a corner, to which they both reacted predictably with wildfire, tearing through whatever was in its path. In this case, poor old Mr. Booth. And so we got something like the truth. Quite like it. But not exactly. Part 6. Day and Night. 1. That autumn, after clearing, I got into my second-choice university to study media, half a mile from the flat grey English Channel, a scene I remembered from childhood holidays. The sea was fringed by a pebble beach of many sad brown stones, every now and then a large, pale blue one, pieces of white shell, knuckles of coral, bright shards easy to mistake for something precious that turned out to be only glass or broken crockery. My parochial city attitude I took with me, along with a pot plant and several pairs of trainers, sure that every soul on the street would be astounded to see the likes of me. But the likes of me were not so uncommon. From London and Manchester, from Liverpool and Bristol, in our big jeans and bomber jackets, with our little twists or shaved heads or tight-pulled buns slick with dacks, with our proud collection of caps. Those first weeks we gravitated towards each other, walking in a defensive gang together along the seafront, readied for insults, but the locals were never as interested in us as we were in ourselves. The salty air cracked our lips. There was never anywhere to get your hair done, but, "You up at the college?" was a genuine, polite inquiry, not an attack on our right to be there. And there were other unexpected advantages. Here I had a maintenance grant, covering food and rent, and weekends were cheap. There was nowhere to go and nothing to do. We spent our spare time together, in each other's rooms, asking after each other's pasts, with a delicacy that felt right to people whose family trees could be traced back only a branch or two before being sunk into obscurity. There was one exception, a boy, a Ghanaian. He came from a long line of doctors and lawyers, and was daily agonized not to find himself at Oxford. But for the rest of us, who were only ever one remove, or occasionally two, distant from father machinists and mother cleaners, from grandmother orderlies and grandfather bus drivers, we still felt we had done the miraculous thing, that we were the first in our line to go. And this in itself was enough. If the institution was almost as fresh as we were, that, too, came to feel like an advantage. There was no grand academic past here. We didn't have to doff our caps to anyone. Our subjects were relatively new, media studies, gender studies, and so were our rooms and the young faculty. It was our place to invent. I thought of Tracy escaping early into that community of dancers, of how jealous I'd been, but now, on the contrary, I felt a little sorry for her. Her world seemed childish to me, just a way of playing with the body, whereas I could walk down the hall and attend a lecture called something like "Thinking the Black Body, a Dialectic," or dance happily in my new friends' rooms, late into the night, and not to the old show tunes but to the new music, to Gangstar or Nas. When I dance now, I didn't have to obey any ancient rules of position or style. I moved as I pleased, as the beats themselves compelled me to move. Poor Tracy. The early morning starts, anxiety on the scales, her aching insteps, the offering up of her young body to the judgment of other people. I was very free compared to her. Here we stayed up late, ate as we pleased, smoked weed. We listened to the golden age of hip-hop, unaware at the time that we were living through a golden age. I got schooled on lyrics by those who knew more than me, and took these informal lessons as seriously as anything I heard in the lecture halls. It was the spirit of the times. We applied high theory to shampoo ads, philosophy to NWA videos. In our little circle, to be conscious was the thing. And after years of forcing my hair straight with the hot comb, I now let it frizz and curl, and took to wearing a small map of Africa around my neck, the larger countries made out in a patchwork leather of black and red, green and gold. I wrote long, emotional essays on the phenomenon of the Uncle Tom. When my mother came down to stay for 3 nights, near the end of that first term, I thought she'd be very impressed by all this. But I'd forgotten that I was not quite like the others, not really the first in our line to go. In this steeplechase, my mother was one leap ahead of me, and I'd forgotten that what was enough for others was never enough for her. Walking along the beach together on that final morning of her stay, she started a sentence which I could see myself somehow escaped her, going far beyond whatever she had intended, but still she said it. She compared her just-completed degree to the one I was starting, called my college a trumped-up hotel, not a university at all, nothing but a student loan trap for kids who didn't know any better, whose parents were uneducated themselves, and I became infuriated. We argued horribly. I told her not to bother visiting again, and she didn't. I expected to feel desolate, as if I had cut through the only cord that connected me to the world, but this feeling didn't arrive. I had, for the first time in my life, a lover, and was so completely occupied with him that I found I could bear the loss of anything and everything else. He was a conscious young man called Rakim. He had renamed himself after the rapper. And his face, long like mine, was of a deeper honey-brown shade, with two very fierce, very dark eyes dropped into it, a prominent nose, and a gently feminine, unexpected overbite, like Huey P. Newton himself. He wore skinny dreadlocks to his shoulders, Converse All-Stars in all weather, little round Lennon glasses. I thought he was the most beautiful man in the world. He thought so, too. He considered himself a 5%er, that is, a god in himself, as all the male sons of Africa were gods. And when he first explained this concept to me, my initial thought was how nice it must be to think of yourself as a living god, how relaxing. But no, as it turned out, it was a heavy duty. It was not easy to be burdened with truth while so many people lived in ignorance, 85% of people, to be exact. But worse than the ignorant were the malicious, the 10% who knew all that Rakim claimed to know, but who worked to actively disguise and subvert the truth, the better to keep the 85 in ignorance and wield advantage over them. In this group of perverse deceivers, Rakim included all the churches, the Nation of Islam itself, the media, the establishment. He had a cool vintage Panthers poster on his wall, in which the big cat looked about to leap out at you, and he spoke often of the violent life of the big American cities, of the sufferings of our people in New York, in Chicago, in Baltimore and L.A., places I had never visited and could barely imagine. Sometimes I had the impression that this ghetto life, though it was 3,000 miles away, was more real to him than the quiet, pleasant seascape in which we actually lived. There were times when the stress of being a poor, righteous teacher could overwhelm. He pulled down the shades in his room, waked and baked, missed lectures, begged me not to leave him alone, spent hours studying the supreme alphabet and the supreme mathematics, which to me looked like only notebook after notebook, filled with letters and numbers and incomprehensible combinations. At other times he appeared well suited to the task of global enlightenment. Serene and knowledgeable, sitting cross-legged like a guru upon the floor, pouring out hibiscus tea for our little circle, dropping science, bopping his head gently to his namesake on the stereo. I had never before met a boy like this. The boys I'd known had had no passions, not really. They couldn't afford them. It was the act of not caring that was important to them. They were in a lifelong contest with each other, and with the world, exactly to demonstrate who cared less, who among them gave less of a fuck. It was a form of defense against loss, which seemed to them inevitable anyway. Rakim was different. All his passions were on the surface. He couldn't hide them. He didn't try to. That's what I loved about him. I didn't notice at first how hard it was for him to laugh. Laughter did not feel appropriate for a god in human form, much less for the girlfriend of a god, and I should probably have read a warning in that. Instead, I followed him devotedly to the strangest places. Numerology! He was besotted with numerology. He showed me how to render my name and numbers, and then how to manipulate these numbers in a particular way, in accordance with the supreme mathematics, until they meant the struggle to triumph over the division within. I didn't understand all of what he said. We were most often stoned during these conversations. But the division he claimed he could see inside of me, I understood very well. Nothing was easier for me to grasp than the idea that I was born half right and half wrong. Yes, as long as I did not think of my actual father and the love I bore him, I could tap this feeling in myself very easily. Such ideas had nothing to do with, and no place in, Rackham's actual schoolwork. His degree was in business studies and hospitality. But they dominated our time together, and little by little I began to feel myself under a cloud of constant correction. Nothing I did was right. He was repelled by the media that I was supposed to be studying, the minstrels and the dancing mummies, the hoofers and the chorus girls. He saw no worth in any of it. Even if my purpose was critique, the whole subject for him was empty, a product of Jewish Hollywood, whom he included en masse in that deceitful 10%. If I tried to talk to him about something I was writing, especially in front of our friends, he would make a point of diminishing or ridiculing it. Too stoned in company once, I made the mistake of trying to explain what I found beautiful about the origins of tap dancing, the Irish crew and the African slaves beating out time with their feet on the wooden decks of those ships, exchanging steps, creating a hybrid form. But Rakim, also stoned and in a cruel mood, stood up, rolled his eyes, stuck his lips out, shook his hands like a minstrel, and said, "Oh, Massa, I so happy on this here slave ship, I be dancing for joy." Cut his eyes at me, sat back down. Our friends looked at the floor. The mortification was intense. For months afterwards, just the thought of it could bring the heat back to my cheeks. But at the time, I didn't blame him for behaving in this way, or feel I loved him any less. My instinct was always to find the fault in myself. My biggest flaw at the time, in his view and my own, was my femininity, which was of the wrong kind. Woman, in Rakim's schema, was intended to be the earth. She grounded man, who was himself pure idea, who dropped science, and I was, in his judgment, far from where I should be, at the root of things. I did not grow plants or cook food, never spoke of babies or domestic matters, and competed with Rakim when and where I should have been supportive. Romance was beyond me. It required a form of personal mystery I couldn't manufacture and disliked in others. I couldn't pretend that my legs do not grow hair, or that my body does not excrete a variety of foul substances, or that my feet aren't flat as pancakes. I could not flirt and saw no purpose in flirting. I did not mind dressing up for strangers, when out at college parties or if we went up to London for the clubs, but in our rooms, within our intimacy, I could not be a girl, nor could I be anybody's baby. I could only be a female human. And the sex, I understood, was of the kind that occurs between friends and equals, bracketing conversation, like a shelf of books between bookends. These deep faults Rakim traced back to the blood of my father, running through me like a poison. But it was also my own doing, my own mind, too busy in itself. A city mind, he called it, the kind that can never know peace because it has nothing natural to meditate upon, only concrete and images of images, simulacra, as we said back then. The cities had corrupted me, making me mannish. Didn't I know that the cities had been built by the 10%, that they were a deliberate tool of oppression, an unnatural habitat for the African soul? His evidence for this theory was sometimes complex, suppressed government conspiracies, scrawled diagrams of architectural plans, obscure quotations ascribed to presidents and civic leaders which I had to take on faith, and at other times simple and damning. Did I know the names of the trees? The names of the flowers? No. But how could an African live this way? whereas he knew them all, though this was due to the fact, which he didn't care to broadcast, that he was a son of rural England, raised first in Yorkshire and then in Dorset, in remote villages, and always the only one of his kind on his street, the only one of his kind in his school, a fact I found more exotic than all his radicalism, all his mysticism. I loved that he knew the names of the counties and how they connected to each other, the names of rivers and where and how exactly they ran into the sea, could tell a mulberry from a blackberry, a copse from a coppice. Never in my life had I gone walking with no purpose, but now I did, accompanying him on his walks, along the stark seafront, down abandoned piers, and sometimes deep into the town, down its little cobbled lanes, crossing parkland, weaving through cemeteries and along A-roads, so far along that we would come upon fields finally and lie down in them. On these long walks, he did not forget his preoccupations. He used them to frame what we saw in ways that could surprise me. The Georgian grandeur of a crescent of houses facing the sea, their facades white as sugar. These were, he explained, also paid for by sugar, built by a plantation owner from our own ancestral island, the island neither of us had ever visited. And the little churchyard in which we sometimes gathered at night to smoke and drink and lie on the grass. This was where Sarah Forbes Benetta was married, a story he retold with such verve you'd have thought he'd married the woman himself. I lay down with him on the scrubby grass of the cemetery and listened. A little 7-year-old West African girl, high-born but caught up in intertribal war, kidnapped by Dahomey raiders. She witnessed the murder of her family, but was later rescued, a word for Kim placed in finger quotes, by an English captain who convinced the King of Dahomey to give her as a present to Queen Victoria. A present from the King of the Blacks to the Queen of the Whites. This captain named her Benetta, after his own ship, and by the time they'd reached England, he'd realized how smart a little girl she was, how unusually quick and alert, as bright as any white girl. And when the Queen met her, she could see all of this, too, deciding to raise Sarah as her goddaughter, marrying her off many years later when she came of age to a rich Yoruba merchant. "In this church," said Rakim. "It happened in this church, right here." I got up on my elbows in the grass and looked over at the church, so unassuming, its simple crenellations and solid red door. "And there were 8 black bridesmaids in a procession," he said, tracing their journey from the gate to the church door with the tip of a glowing joint. "Imagine it! 8 black and 8 white, and the African men walked with the white girls and the white men with the African girls." Even in the darkness I could see it all. The 12 grey horses pulling the carriage, and the magnificent ivory lace of the gown, and the great crowd gathered to see the spectacle spilling out of the church, onto the lawn, and back all the way to the lych gate, standing on the low stone walls and hanging in the trees, just to catch a look at her. I think of how Rakim gathered his information back then, in the public libraries, in the college archive, doggedly reading old newspapers, examining microfiche, following footnotes. And then I think of him now, in the age of the internet, and how perfectly happy he must be, or else how consumed, to the point of raving madness. Now I can find out myself in a moment the name of that captain, and can learn in the same click what he thought of the girl he gifted to a queen. Since her arrival in the country, she has made considerable progress in the study of the English language and manifests great musical talent and intelligence of no common order. Her hair is short, black, and curling, strongly indicative of her African birth, while her features are pleasing and handsome, and her manners and conduct most mild and affectionate to all about her. I know now that her Yoruba name was Aina, meaning difficult birth, a name you give to a child who was born with her umbilical cord tied round her neck. I can see a photo of Aina in her high-necked Victorian corsetry, with her face closed, her body perfectly still. I remember that Rakim had a refrain, always proudly declaimed, with his overbite pulled back over his teeth. "We have our own kings! We have our own queens!" I would nod along for the sake of peace, but in truth some part of me always rebelled. Why did he think it so important for me to know that Beethoven dedicated a sonata to a mulatto violinist, or that Shakespeare's Dark Lady really was dark, or that Queen Victoria had deigned to raise a child of Africa, bright as any white girl. I did not want to rely on each European fact having its African shadow, as if without the scaffolding of the European fact, everything African might turn to dust in my hands. It gave me no pleasure to see that sweet-faced girl dressed like one of Victoria's own children, frozen in a formal photograph, with a new kind of cord round her neck. I always wanted life. Movement. One slow Sunday, Rakim blew some smoke out of his mouth and started talking about going to see a real film. It was French, playing at the College Film Society that same day, and over the course of the morning we had steadily torn apart a flyer for it, using the glossy card to make many little roaches for our joints. But you could still make out the face of a brown girl in a blue headscarf who, Rakim now claimed, had something of my features, or I had hers. She was staring directly at me with what was left of her right eye. We dragged ourselves across campus to the media room and sat in the uncomfortable fold-up chairs. The film started. But with the fog in my head, it was quite hard to understand what I was watching. It seemed to be made out of many little pieces, like a stained glass window, and I did not know which parts were important or on what scenes Rakim felt I should focus, although maybe everyone in the room felt the same. Maybe it's part of the effect of that film, that each viewer should see something different in it. I can't say what Rakim saw. I saw tribes. Many different tribes, from every corner of the world, operating under the internal rules of their groups, and then edited together in a complex pattern that appeared to have, in the moment, its own weird logic. I saw Japanese girls in traditional costume, dancing in formation, making strangely hip-hop movements on their elevated gita. Cape Verdeans waiting with perfect, timeless patience for a boat that may or may not come. I saw white blonde children walking down an otherwise deserted Icelandic road in a town painted black by volcanic ash. I heard a dubbed and disembodied woman's voice speak over these images. She was contrasting African time to the time of Europe and time as it is experienced in Asia. She said that 100 years ago, mankind was confronted with the question of space, but that the problem of the 20th century was the simultaneous existence of different notions of time. I looked over at Rakim. He was making notes in the darkness, hopelessly stoned. It got to the point where the images themselves were too much for him. He could only listen to the woman's voice and make his notes faster and faster as the film went on, until he'd written half the script out in his pad. For me, the film had no beginning or end, and this was not an unpleasant sensation, just a mysterious one. As if time itself had expanded to make space for this infinite parade of tribes. On and on it went, refusing to end. There were parts, I admit, I slept through, only to awaken sharply when my chin hit my chest, at which point I would look up and find myself confronted with a bizarre image, a temple consecrated to cats, Jimmy Stewart chasing Kim Novak up a spiral staircase, images made all the more alien because I hadn't followed what came before and would not see what came after. And in one of these lucid gaps between waking up and falling asleep, I heard once more that same disembodied voice speak of the essential indestructibility of women and of men's relation to it. "For it is the job of men," she said, "to stop women from realizing their own indestructibility and for as long as possible." Each time I woke with a start, I could feel Rakim's impatience with me, his need to correct me, and I began to fear the closing credits. I could imagine the exact intensity and length of the arguments that would follow them, in that dangerous moment when we were out of the cinema, back in his room and far from witnesses. I never wanted that film to end. A few days later, I dumped Rakim, in a cowardly way, in the form of a letter slipped under his door. In it, I blamed myself and said I hoped we could be friends, but he sent me one back in a livid red ink, informing me he knew that I was in the 10% and that from now on he would be on his guard against me. He was as good as his word. For the rest of my college life, he would turn on his heel if he saw me coming, cross the street if he spotted me in town, leave any lecture room I entered. 2 years later, at graduation, a white woman hurried across the hall and grabbed my mother's sleeve and said, "I thought it was you. You're an inspiration to our young people, you really are.
but I'm so glad to meet you. And this is my son. My mother turned around with her face already fixed in an expression I knew rather well by then. Gentle condescension mixed with pride, the same face she often had now when on television, whenever she was called upon to speak for those who had no voice. She put out her hand to greet this white woman's son, who would not at first come out from behind his mother, and when he did, looked at the ground, his skinny dreads obscuring his face, though I knew him at once by his Converse All-Stars, poking out from beneath his graduation gown. 2. On my fifth visit, I went alone. Strode straight through the airport, out into the heat, feeling a glorious competency. To my left, to my right, were the lost and the wary, beach-bound tourists, evangelicals in their oversized T-shirts, and all the serious young German anthropologists. No representative led me to my vehicle. I was not waiting for the rest of my party. I had my coins ready for the cripples in the car park, my cab fare already tucked in the back of my jeans, my half a dozen phrases. Nakam! Jamungam? Jamarek! Car keys and crumpled white linen long gone. Black jeans, a black silk shirt, and big gold swinging hoops in my ears. I believed I'd mastered local time. I knew now how long it took to get to the ferry and at what time of day, so that when my cab pulled up to the gangway, hundreds of other people had already done my waiting for me. All I had to do was get out of the car and walk right on board. The ship lurched from the shore. On the top deck, the sway pitched me forward, through two layers of people up to the barrier, and happy to be there, like someone just then pushed into their lover's arms. I looked down at all the life and movement below. Jostling people, squawking chickens, dolphins leaping in the foam, narrowboats reeling in our wake, half-starved dogs running along the shoreline. Here and there I spotted what I knew now to be the tablighi, their short trousers flapping around their ankles, because if they were any longer they would get dirty, and the prayers of the dirty don't get answered, so you end up burning your feet in hell. But beyond their dress, it was really their stillness that marked them out. Amid all that activity they looked paused, either reading from their prayer books or sitting in silence, often with their coal-rimmed eyes closed, and a blissful smile nestled in their henna-stained beards, so peaceful compared to the rest of us. Dreaming of their pure and modern iman, maybe, of small nuclear families worshipping Allah in discreet apartments, of praise without magic, of direct access to God without local intermediaries, of sterilized hospital circumcisions, babies born without any celebratory dancing, women who did not think to pair a hot pink hijab with a lime green lycra mini-dress. I wondered how hard it must be to maintain this dream, right now, on this ferry, as the unruly everyday faith unfolded all around them. I settled onto a bench. On my left sat one of these spiritual young men, his eyes closed, clutching a folded prayer mat to his chest. On my other side, a glamorous girl with two sets of eyebrows, one pair painted strangely above her own, who sat joggling a small bag of cashews in her hands. I considered all the months that separated my first ferry trip from this one, the Illuminated Academy for Girls, which, for convenience's sake, and to save everyone the shame of saying it, we abbreviated, behind Amy's back, to IAG, had survived its first year. Thrived, if you counted success in column inches. For the rest of us, it had been a periodic ordeal. Intense whenever the visits rolled round, or some crisis brought the embattled headmaster into our meeting rooms in London or New York via fraught video conference. Oddly distant at all other times. I often had cause to recall Granger, in Heathrow, the night of our first return, hugging me round my shoulders as we queued for customs. None of this looks real to me now. Something's changed. Can't be the same after seeing what I've seen. But in a few days he was exactly the same. We all were. We left taps running, abandoned plastic bottles after a few sips, bought a single pair of jeans for the same sum as a trainee teacher's yearly wage. If London was unreal, if New York was unreal, they were powerful stage shows. As soon as we were back inside them, they not only seemed real, but the only possible reality,
and decisions made about the village from these locations always appeared to have a certain plausibility while we were making them. And only later, when one or other of us arrived back here and crossed this river, did the potential absurdity of whatever it was become clear. 4 months ago, for example, it had seemed important in New York to teach the theory of evolution to these children and their teachers, many of whom had never so much as heard of the name Darwin. It seemed far less of a priority in the village itself when we reached it in the middle of the rainy season to find a third of the kids off with malaria, half a classroom ceiling fallen in, the toilet contract unfulfilled, and the solar panel-powered electricity circuits rusted and corrupted. But our biggest problem, as Fern had predicted, was not our pedagogical illusions, exactly, but the wavering nature of Amy's attention. Her new thing was technology. She had begun to spend a lot of social time with the brilliant young people of Silicon Valley and liked to consider herself one of their tribe. Basically a nerd. She'd become very responsive to their vision of a world transformed, saved, by technology. In the first flush of this new interest, she did not abandon IAG, or poverty reduction, as much as patch the fresh preoccupation onto the old ones, with sometimes alarming results. "We're going to give each one of these damn girls a laptop. That's going to be their exercise book. That's their library, their teacher, their everything." Which Fern then had to massage back into some semblance of reality. He stayed on the ground, not for mere weeks, but for whole seasons, partly on affection for the village and his own commitment to his role there, but also, I knew, to avoid working any more closely with Amy than his preferred distance of 4,000 miles. He saw what no one else saw. He noted the growing resentment of the boys who had been left to fester in the old school, which, though Amy sporadically rained a little money on it, was now little more than a ghost town in which children sat around waiting for teachers unpaid so long they'd stopped coming to work. The government seemed to have withdrawn from the village generally. Many other previously well-running, or reasonably well-running, services now languished cruelly. The clinic had not reopened. A huge pothole in the road just outside the village had been left to crater and spread. An Italian environmental scientist's reports of dangerous levels of pesticides in the groundwater well were ignored no matter how many times Fern tried to alert the relevant ministries. Perhaps this kind of thing would have happened anyway. But it was hard to avoid the suspicion that the village was being punished for its connection with Amy, or deliberately neglected in the expectation that Amy's money would flow into the gap. One problem you could not find written down in any of the reports, but Fern and I were both acutely aware of it, although we experienced it from opposite ends. Neither of us bothered discussing it with Amy anymore. "But what if I love him?" was her only response when we combined forces, by way of conference call, in an attempted intervention. Instead, we worked around her, swapping information like two PIs on the same case. I probably was the one who noticed it first, in London. I kept walking in on sweet nothings being passed back and forth, at her desktop, on her phone, always closed or shut down the moment I entered whichever room. Then she stopped being shy. When he passed the AIDS test she'd made him take, she was so glad she told me about it. I got used to seeing Lamin's disembodied head in a corner, smiling at me, streaming at us live from, I presumed, the only internet cafe in Barra. He was there at breakfast with the kids in the mornings and waved goodbye to them when their tutors arrived. He'd appear for dinner, like another guest at the table. He began to be included in meetings, the ridiculous, creative kind. "Lam, what do you think about this corset?" But also in serious meetings with accountants, the business manager, the PRs. From Fern's end, the situation was less queasily romantic, more concrete. Lamin's compound got a new front door, then a toilet, then interior dividing walls, then a new roof of tile. This did not go unnoticed. A flat-screen TV had caused the latest trouble. "The alcalde called a meeting about it on Tuesday," Fern informed me when I called him to tell him the jet was taking off. "Lamin was away in Dakar visiting family. Mostly the young people came. Everybody was very upset. It came down to a long discussion about how and when Lamin joined the Illuminati." I was in the process of texting Fern to give him my latest location when I heard a commotion the other side of the engine room, and looked up and saw bodies parting, moving towards the stairs, to avoid a skinny, flailing man who now came into view, shouting, waving his bony arms in some form of severe distress. I turned to the man to my left. His face remained placid, eyes closed. The lady to my right raised both pairs of her brows and said,
"Drunk man, oh my!"
Two soldiers appeared and were on top of him in a moment. They took him by each of his wild arms and tried to force him down onto a spot on the bench a little way along from us. But each time his narrow buttocks connected with the seat, he sprang up as if the wood were on fire, and so the plan changed. Now they dragged him towards the entrance of the engine room, directly opposite me, and tried to force him through the little door and down the dark steps to where he could no longer be seen. I knew by then he was epileptic. I could see the foam gathering at the corners of his mouth, and at first I thought this was what they didn't understand. As they twisted him out of his T-shirt, I kept shouting, "Epileptic! He's epileptic!" until four eyebrows explained, "Sister, they know this." They knew this, but had no gentle arsenal of movements. They were the kind of soldiers instructed in brutality only. The more the man convulsed, the more he foamed, the more he infuriated them, and after a brief struggle in the doorway, where he momentarily convulsed in such a way that his limbs locked rigid like a toddler who refuses to be moved, they kicked him down the stairs, reached behind themselves, and closed the door. We heard struggle and terrible screams, dull connecting punches. Then silence.
"What are you doing to that poor man?"
cried Four Eyebrows beside me. But when the door reopened, she lowered her eyes and returned to her cashews, and I didn't say any of the things I thought I was going to say, and the crowd parted and the soldiers walked down the stairs unmolested. We were the weak and they were the strong, and whatever force is meant to mediate between the weak and the strong was not present, not on the ferry, not in the country. Only when the soldiers were out of sight did the tabligi, who was sitting next to me, with two other nearby men, enter the engine room and retrieve the epileptic and bring him out into the light. The tabligi lay him tenderly across his lap. It looked like the Pieta. He had two bleeding split eyes but was alive and calm. A portion of bench was cleared for him, and for the rest of the crossing he lay there, shirtless, gently moaning until we docked, when he stood up like any other commuter, climbed down the stairs and merged into the hordes heading for Barra. How happy I was to see Hauer, genuinely happy. It was lunchtime when I kicked open the door, and also cashew season. Everyone was arranged in circles of five or six, crouched around large bowls of the fire-blackened nuts that had to now be removed from their burnt shells, and placed in a series of luridly tie-dyed buckets. Even very small children could do this, so it was all hands on deck, even for incompetents like Fern, who was being laughed at by Hauer for his relatively tiny mound of shells.
"Look at you! You look like Miss Beyoncé herself! Well, I hope your nails are not too fancy, my lady, because now you have to come and show this poor Fern man how it's done. Even Mohammed has a bigger pile, and he's three!"
I abandoned my single rucksack at the door. I had also learnt to pack, and went to hug Hauer round her strong, narrow back.
"Still no baby?"
she whispered in my ear, and I whispered the same back, and we hugged yet more tightly and laughed into each other's necks. It was very surprising to me that Hauer and I should have found a bond in this, across continents and cultures, but that's how it was. For just as, in London and New York, Amy's world, and therefore mine, had erupted into babies, her own and the babies of her friends, dealing with them and talking about them, so that nothing seemed to exist except birth, and not just in the private realm, but also all newspapers, the television, stray songs on the radio seemed, to me, obsessed with the subject of fertility in general, and of the fertility of women like me in particular. Just so Hauer was coming under pressure in the village, as the time passed and people cottoned on to the fact that the policeman in Banjul was only a decoy, and Hauer herself a new kind of girl, perhaps uncircumcised, certainly unmarried, with no children, and no immediate plans for having any. "Still no baby" had become our shorthand and catchphrase for all this, our mutual situation,
and it seemed the funniest thing in the world whenever we exchanged the phrase with each other. We giggled and groaned over it, and only occasionally did it occur to me, and only when I was back in my own world, that I was 32 and Howard 10 years younger. Fern stood up from his cashew disaster and wiped the ash off his hands onto his trousers. She returns. Lunch was brought to us right away. We ate in a corner of the yard, our plates on our knees, both hungry enough to ignore the fact that nobody else got a lunch break from cashew crushing.
You look very well, said Fern, beaming at me. Very happy.
The tin door at the back of the compound was wide open, giving onto a view of Howard's family's land. Several acres of purple-tinged cashew trees, pale yellow bush, and scorched black hillocks of ash that marked where Howard and her grandmothers burnt, once a month, huge pyres of household waste and plastic. It was somehow lush and barren simultaneously, and beautiful to me in this mix. I saw that Fern was right. This was a place in which I was happy. Aged 32 1/4, I was finally having my year off.
But what is a year off?
Oh, it's when you're young and you spend a year in some distant country, learning its ways, communing with the community. We could never afford one.
Your family?
Well, yes, but I was thinking specifically of me and my mate Tracy. We just used to watch people go on them and then slag them off when they got back. I laughed to myself at the memory.
Slag off? What is this?
Oh, we used to call them poverty tourists. You know, those kinds of students who'd come back with their stupid year-off ethnic trousers and African hand-carved, overpriced statuary made in some factory in Kenya. We used to think they were so idiotic. But maybe Fern himself had been one of these optimistic young hippie travellers. He sighed and lifted his finished bowl from the floor to rescue it from a curious goat.
What cynical young people you were, you and your mate Tracy.
The cashew shelling was going to continue into the night. To avoid helping, I suggested a walk to the well on the thin excuse of collecting water for a morning shower, and Fern, usually so conscientious, surprised me by saying he would come. Along the way, he told a story about visiting Musa, Howard's cousin, to check on the health of a new baby. When he had reached the place, a small, very basic dwelling Musa had built himself on the edge of the village, he found Musa alone. His wife and children had gone to see her mother. He invited me in. He was a little lonely, I think. I noticed he had a small old TV with VHS attached. I was surprised. He is always so frugal, like all mashallah. But he said a Peace Corps woman who was going back to the States had left it to him. He was very keen to let me know he never watched Nollywood movies on it or any of the telenovelas or anything like that. Not anymore. Only pure films. Did I want to see one? I said sure. We sit down and in a minute I realize it's one of these training videos from Afghanistan. Boys dressed all in black doing backflips with Kalashnikovs. I said to him, Musa, do you understand what is being said in this video? Because a speech in Arabic was droning on, you can't imagine, and I could tell he didn't understand a word. And he says to me, so dreamy, I love the way they leap. I think to him it was like a beautiful dance video, a radical Islamic dance video. He told me, the way they move, it makes me want to be more pure inside. Poor Musa. Anyway, I thought you would find this funny, because I know you are interested in dance. He added, when I didn't laugh. 3. The first email I ever received came from my mother. She sent it from a computer lab in the basement of University College London, where she had just taken part in a public debate, and I received it on a computer in my own college library. The content was a single Langston Hughes poem. She made me recite it in full when I called her later that evening to prove it had arrived. While night comes on gently, dark like me. Ours was the first graduating class to receive email addresses, and my mother, always curious about new things, acquired a battered old Compaq to which she attached a doddering modem. Together we entered this new space that now opened up between people, a connection with no precise beginning or end, that was always potentially open, and my mother was one of the first people I knew to understand this and exploit it fully.
Most emails sent in the mid-90s tended to be long and letter-like. They began and ended with traditional greetings, the ones we'd all previously used on paper, and they were keen to describe the surrounding